I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food, and it's April. You know what April is. April is my birthday month, and I'm always looking for reasons to celebrate life. So I'm celebrating all of April, and there's a couple of things coming up in April that some of you may want to know about. Here in New York City, we're having the 12th annual Veggie Pride Parade. You can find out more at veggieprideparade.org. It's April 14th. It's a free annual event that brings the community together to celebrate animal-friendly, environmentally sustainable, and healthy lifestyles. There's a parade at 11 in the morning, and then there are speakers and demonstrations from 1 to 5 p.m., and I'll be there exhibiting and speaking. So if you're around the neighborhood, please stop by and say hi. It's really a fun event. The weather's usually terrible. It's usually either very hot or very cold, but we all have a good time. And the other event, of course, is April 22nd is Earth Day, which happens to be my birthday. And woohoo! There'll be lots going on for that event. Now, let's go to the main event today. I'm going to bring on my guest in a moment. William Lee, MD, is an internationally renowned medical doctor, researcher, and president, and a founder of the Angiogenesis Foundation. His groundbreaking work has led to the development of more than 30 new medical treatments, has impacted more than 50 million people worldwide, and covers more than 70 diseases, including cancer, diabetes, blindness, heart disease, and obesity. His TED Talk, Can We Eat to Starve Cancer?, has garnished more than 11 million views. Dr. Lee has appeared on the Dr. Oz Show, CNN, and MSNBC, and has been featured in USA Today, Time, The Atlantic, and Zero Magazine. Oh, magazine. That's not a zero. Dr. Lee has served on the faculty of Harvard Medical School and presented at the Vatican's Unite to Cure conference. Welcome to It's All About Food.
Thank you, Karen. It's a pleasure to be on.
Yes, and I'm really honored to have this time to speak with you. We're going to be talking about one of my very favorite subjects, Eat to Beat Disease, which happens to be the title of your new book.
Yes, it is. It's really great to be able to discuss my book with your listeners because it is the book that I wanted to read myself, which is how do we clear up all this confusion there is about food and health?
Well, there's a lot to talk about in this 468-page book. And before we get started, I just wanted to mention one thing that happened today, which you probably know about. There is the new International Journal of Disease Reversal and Prevention, and their first edition is available now, and it's free. And I just wanted to mention it because Dr. Lee happens to be on the editorial advisory board, along with many other esteemed medical doctors and PhDs, all of them we know and love. And so if you are interested, go to IJDRP.org. That stands for International Journal of Disease Reversal and Prevention. And you can register and read this very first wonderful edition. What do you think about this new International Journal of Disease Reversal and Prevention, Dr. Lee?
Well, Karen, you know, as a member of the medical community and as a researcher who's been, you know, working on many different types of research for cancer and other diseases really over the last 30 years, I realized both in practice as well as in my research that way too much attention has been focused on disease intervention and chasing and treating diseases, which is a worthy goal. But not enough actually has been, attention has been spent on looking at how to prevent disease or even reverse it. So as a result, we wind up getting into this mindset where, you know, in the public, we fear diseases. When we have them, you know, we give ourselves into the medical system, which we trust will actually help us cure them. But oftentimes, diseases are difficult to cure, mostly because nobody's really thinking about how do we get the patient or how do we get ourselves, our bodies, back to health. And that's really one of the themes in my new book, Eat to Beat Disease, which is how does our body stay healthy to begin with? Why don't we get sick more often? What's actually at work inside our body to prevent disease, protect our health? And then that then sets up the question, how does food actually impact on those defense systems?
Okay, so we're jumping into this beautiful book, Eat to Beat Disease. And I mentioned before, it's one of my favorite subjects. You may know, my listeners know, 13 years ago, I had a journey with advanced ovarian cancer. And that's when I really started focusing on eating to beat my disease. And one of the things I learned was there's a lot of things that we can't control. There's the environment, there's emotional issues, and there's what we eat, which we can control. But there are many issues that can affect us negatively in our lives. But we can get through them a whole lot better if we're eating well and we're healthy to begin with. Because healthier people heal faster. Healthier people can go through a surgery better. So there's all kinds of you can't avoid some illnesses, but if you're going to be treated, it's best to be as strong as you can.
Absolutely. And, you know, the body actually wants to heal itself. And this is why, you know, although some kids do get very serious illnesses, most of us have gone through childhood being able to bounce back from pretty much anything that the environment or, you know, our sick community actually throws at us. And so that's really one of the things that I was trying to tap into when I wrote the book, which is, what's the secret to health? How do we define it more than just the absence of disease? And once we understand what that is, and, you know, what I write about is that health is actually the result of a number of natural defense systems that are hardwired in our bodies that actually are firing on all cylinders from the time we're born to our very last breath. And by understanding that, we have really kind of an entirely new way of thinking about, you know, our health, how to stay away from disease, how to reverse disease, and also the role of food.
So you've come up with five defense systems, and I would like you to just briefly touch on them. They're in the first part of your book, which I found fascinating. And I also want to say that you did a really fine job of explaining some very complicated stuff in very easy-to-digest terms.
Well, thank you so much, Karen. I mean, look, my book is organized in three parts that really lead from the beginning to, you know, explaining the body. And then at the very end, you know, how do you put it all together into everyday terms? And so really for the first part of it, I you know, wanted to introduce, unlike most books on diet and health that are all about what you should cut out of your diet if you want to be healthy. And, you know, there's all kinds of shame and guilt factors laden into or implied really in talking about food and health, I really kind of don't even go there. What I basically say is that I take readers to the state-of-the-art, the cutting edge, the frontiers of where researchers are actually delivering information about health. And so I talk about five defense systems, and one of them is called angiogenesis. It is the growth of blood vessels in our body. It's how our body actually keeps its circulation healthy. Our circulation brings oxygen and nutrients to every cell in our body. It's a very powerful defense system that keeps everything fed. So we feed our blood vessels. Our blood vessels, in turn, feed everything else in our body. That's one defense system that is activated by food. Another defense system is our regenerative system, our stem cells. And I like to talk about the fact that most of us, when we were kids, were taught by our teachers that salamanders and starfish can regenerate, but humans can't. Well, science has now turned that upside down because we now know that people do regenerate. We do regenerate from the inside out very slowly. And what's really amazing is that, you know, you hear all this news about stem cell this, stem cell that, you know, the industry is trying to develop stem cell therapies. But in fact, our body naturally uses stem cells to heal, and foods can actually activate those. And I'll come back to talk about that. A third defense system is a term that probably every one of your listeners has been hearing about, and if they haven't, they will now pay attention to. It's called the microbiome. The microbiome is really the healthy bacteria that lives inside our body. 39 trillion bacteria live inside us, in our gut, in all the cavities in our body. And so actually, we're all infected, but we're not sick. That's pretty amazing, right?
Yeah.
Like, how can that be? And it's because, you know, our bodies turn out to be this ecosystem with good guys, good bacteria, and good cells, and a few bad players as well. But just like any neighborhood that is built up of lots of different families, as long as everybody generally is well-intentioned and behaves, it's a safe neighborhood. And that's really what this microbiome does. And And whatever we feed ourselves feeds our bacteria. And our bacteria do all kinds of things in our body, from boost our immune system, speed up healing, to even help coax our brain to release the social hormone, oxytocin, which is sort of the feel-good hormone that our bodies release whenever we get a hug from somebody we love. So that's the microbiome. The next defense system, the fourth one I talk about, is DNA protection. So most of us think about DNA as our genetic code, which it is, and we think about DNA from Ancestry.com or 23andMe. These tests, consumer tests, tell us a little bit more about ourselves. But it turns out our DNA is way more than that. It's a protection system against the environment. And so when does our environment damage us? When we go out and go to the beach to get a tan. DNA damage occurs with ultraviolet radiation. You're stuck in traffic. Sun is shining in through the windshield. DNA damage due to the radiation. You're smelling secondhand smoke from somebody standing nearby. You're breathing that in. DNA damage. You're filling up your car gas tank at a filling station. If you're not standing upwind, you're standing downwind. You smell those fumes. DNA damage. The good news that I write about is that our DNA is hardwired to protect itself. So when harm comes to it, it neutralizes the harm. When there is damage to it, it can rebuild itself, and foods can do that. And my last defense system, the fifth defense system, is our immune system. And everyone is familiar with our immune system because every grandmother has told their grandkids that our immune system is important to be strong because it protects us against infections. But we now know that the immune system is more powerful than we ever imagined, and it can actually protect us against cancer as well. And food can influence that. So these five defense systems, antigenesis, stem cells, regeneration, microbiome, DNA protection, and immunity, these are the five foundations of health that I write about in the first part of my book. And the second part of my book is really sort of, uncloaking the scientific evidence of all the foods that activate those defense systems.
So these defense systems, if we get out of balance, and many of us have way out of balance, they can act against us. So the angiogenesis can create blood vessels that help cancer grow. And the microbiome, when we feed the bad bacteria, they might eat holes in our gut and cause all kinds of havoc, and on and on and on. So it's a balance.
Exactly.
To get us to work for us.
Right.
Not
well,
against us.
Just as you might think, it's common sense. Our health is a balance between sort of the good forces and the forces that are not so good. And as long as the scales are tipped on a whole towards healthy behavior, healthy activity, and healthy defense, we're probably going to be okay. And, people always ask that question, how does somebody live to be, in their 90s or even 100? It's probably because they have good defenses. And then the other question is, how does somebody who's like a runner, jogger, vegan, somebody who's always taking care of their body, why do they, suddenly get sick and die? And it's probably because one of their defenses failed them. So, again, it's not assigning blame to something. It's like these systems that are protecting us from day zero.
Even before day zero.
Oh, yeah. Even in the mother's womb.
Yeah. And, bringing up the mother's womb, you mentioned so many fascinating studies and information and things that we understood originally that we know weren't quite right. So you had mentioned that at one point the medical community thought there were things that were sterile in our bodies, like a pregnant woman's womb and her breast milk, and then we learned that they're not. Is any part of the human body sterile?
Well, when I went to medical school, we were told that the healthy body has sterile urine and that our blood is sterile, no bacteria in the blood and everything else, and breast milk is sterile, and in the womb, the amniotic fluid that bathes and supports and nourishes the developing baby is sterile. Well, again, this is the nature of science and research, is that our knowledge changes as new information comes to light. And what we now know is that these 39 trillion bacteria that live inside us live everywhere. They're everywhere, and they're doing something that, a lot of which the functions we don't even barely understand. So it's we're at the beginning of this. So, for example, you mentioned breast milk, and it turns out that breast milk is, in fact, not really sterile. There's bacteria that migrate in the body of the mom around childbirth so that when the baby begins to breastfeed, the bacteria are injected through the milk into the baby's gut, really as one way of colonizing or giving the baby the healthy gut bacteria from the mom. Think about how astounding that is, that bacteria that lived in the mom's gut could migrate. And we think they do this by, you know, calling on cells like an Uber and moving into those cells, getting into the bloodstream, and then getting dropped off by the cellular Uber right by that nipple, waiting for the suckle to occur, and then they jet that bacteria into the baby's gut. So mom's gut to baby's gut through the nipple. Amazing. We also know that even in the uterus over the 9 months, that the mom begins giving baby healthy bacteria right through that uterine fluid, the amniotic fluid. I can tell you for a fact, we used to consider that to be a sterile fluid. It's not. It contains small amounts of healthy bacteria that is being transferred from mom to baby. Even in the eyes, by the way, you know, where our eyes are filled with fluid and jelly, we're beginning to realize that there's probably healthy gut bacteria, eye bacteria that's actually helping to create some functions within our eyeballs as well. And so we're at the beginning of an entirely new era. And I always tell my scientist colleagues how important it is for us to be humble, because we're just really beginning to discover what health actually is.
I imagine that some of our understanding improves because the technology improves and we're able to see things that we couldn't see before and see things that are even smaller and smaller than we were before. My background is in chemical engineering, and I worked for the semiconductor industry, which is now the nanotechnology industry, and everything gets smaller and smaller and smaller. I loved your military analogy when you were talking about T cells and B cells. Mm-hmm. And it was really fun to read about it and see how they worked in the body. But that led me to think about how do researchers even see these things or figure them out?
Well, this is the interesting part of teasing apart, peeling back the layers of the onion of science to figure out how do we come to this conclusion for something we can't see, right? I mean, I'll answer your question about the immune system in 1 second, but I mean, think about what we're even hearing about in the news, you know, imagining what's actually happening on Mars or in, you know, or a Kepler planet that is, you know, light, hundreds of light years away. Science is allowing, as you say, us to peer deeper and deeper, further and further, and at greater levels of detail to figure out what's going on. So, okay, let's talk about the immune system. So, you know, to somebody who's not a scientist, the immune system is a little bit of a kind of a mystery black box, let's say, and some kind of shield that if bacteria tries to get in our body, our immune system takes care of it. Somehow it must wipe it out. Well, we know that there are immune cells, which is what doctors measure when they do a regular blood test. We can see how many white blood cells, which are an important marker of our immune system. And we've got lots of white blood cells that are high in our blood. It's because our body's reacting to something and we might have an infection that we're trying to fight off. And a fever can often be a reflection of our body trying to fight it off as well. But white blood cells are not just one type of cell. It is, you know, dozens and dozens of different types of cells that are specialized in what they do. And the analogy that I give in the book is that when a foreign invader tries to come into the homeland of our body and wreak havoc, it's like, you know, terrorists trying to penetrate, you know, a fort. Essentially, the soldiers that are there, and some of them fly airplanes, some of them are ground troops, some of them drive tanks, you know, some of them are special forces with special weapons. They all go to work. They're woken up really by these attackers. And the attackers, by the way, could be bacteria, they could be viruses, but they can also be cancer. Anything that is foreign and abnormal will wake up our defenses, and they will go to town. And even before there is an attack, there are immune cells that act like sentries. They actually patrol our body making sure that there's no trouble. And if there is, they spot it as soon as possible and then relay the signal to the rest of the troops so they can decide, the commanders of the body can decide which types of cells to send out to defend us and when. So that's sort of like a simple way of describing the stories that I tell in the book about how the immune system works. And yeah, I sort of had to try to imagine, you know, how the biology part of immunology could be translated into a way that pretty much everyone can understand.
It is indeed fascinating. And this understanding helps further the research so that we can learn how the system works and learn how to work with it so that we can cure and deal with some of these diseases. So now we have immunotherapy, which it looks very positive and is positive in some instances, and it seems better than chemotherapy because chemotherapy seems to work at killing everything, and it either kills the disease or kills you first, and there's a lot of damage along the way.
Mm-hmm.
Immunotherapy works with our immune system, but immunotherapy doesn't work for everybody. And so are there things we can do if we need immunotherapy and we want it to work, but it's not working for us? Because we're all different.
Yes. Yeah, no, exactly. Well, so first of all, a lot of what we're learning about the power of the immune system is coming from immunotherapy, which is a new type of cancer treatment that doesn't actually kill cancer cells directly. So it's not like chemotherapy where you're putting poison in the body and it kills the cancer cells as it kills everything else as well. Immunotherapy mostly wakes up our body's immune system or uncloaks cancer cells that are hiding from our immune system and lets our body do what it's supposed to do, which is, you know, get those soldiers and those protective troops to really defend against something like cancer. But we know that it's so powerful that in some cases, it can even take an elderly person, you know, somebody in their 80s, who you would think had a weaker immune system. Nope, it's powerful enough when it's given a chance to completely wipe out cancer even after it's spread. Great example is former President Jimmy Carter, who had a melanoma that had spread, including into his brain, and he was given one of the first immunotherapy medicines out there, and you know, his cancer completely disappeared, and he's, you know, to this day, you know, doing the things that he loves and back in his state of health. So the problem is that not everybody responds so dramatically or so, quote, miraculously. And until recently, we haven't really understood why. But a stunning research finding that I describe in my book came a few years ago, and it was announced by a researcher from Paris who looked at cancer patients who were giving immunotherapy, and either they responded or didn't respond. And then this is Professor Laurence Zitvogel, looked at every parameter she could evaluate between the responding patients versus the non-responding patients to immune therapy. In other words, the people who did really well and had a great benefit and great response to the treatment, cancer treatment, or the people who unfortunately didn't have a response. And she found that the biggest difference was one bacteria, and that one gut bacteria is called Akkermansia mucinophila, or Akkermansia. So that's all of a sudden you have, you know, a player in the microbiome, another one of our defense systems that actually influences our immune system in a cancer patient where, you know, the treatment's supposed to try to boost our immune system. And guess what? You cannot actually eat Akkermansia as a probiotic. Mm-hmm. The only way you can grow Akkermansia is actually with food. So a cup of cranberry juice, or a cup of pomegranate juice, an 8-ounce cup, over a couple of weeks will actually restore the mucus lining in your gut that the Akkermansia love to grow in. And so eating food can actually change the environment of your gut to a form that life-saving bacteria loves to grow in so that the medicines that you're applying work. So this is food is medicine helping medicine.
It's fascinating. And you mentioned cranberries and pomegranates, and those two foods appear numerous times throughout your book, as other foods do. because not only are they good for one thing, but they may be good for something else. And so what I did was, while I was reading it, I said, okay, let's pick a disease and see how often you bring it up and what things are good for it. And I picked lymphoma, and I noticed a number of times you mentioned different things that would work for lymphoma, and they'll probably work for other things, but I thought we could talk about them. So quercetin was one of them.
Well, so quercetin is a natural compound found in a number of different food types. And depending on what, and it actually has, it also boosts the immune system. It's a powerful anti-angiogenic, cancer starving, so it cuts off the blood supply to tumors, and it also boosts the immune system. And so foods, you know, that are, that actually fit that model of having quercetin actually can actually have a benefit. Same thing as, you know, many of the foods that you're sort of describing is this common denominator of Mother Nature's kind of warehouse or treasure house of bioactives. That's really what's the most amazing thing about these bioactives. So lymphoma is a cancer that requires a blood supply. And quercetin can actually help to cut off that blood supply, and it can actually boost the immune system, which can actually help healthy immune cells fight those diseased immune cells.
Okay, so the next one was, and I love this one, genistein, which is from soy.
Right, right. So, you know, look, so genistein is a natural chemical compound found in soy. And it actually is a powerful way that eating soy can starve cancer by cutting off its blood supply. So, genistein is one of those anti-angiogenic substances that's found in food. Soy is one of the biggest, most richest storehouses of genistein. And here's the thing. Soy's got a kind of a scary reputation. A lot of people think that women should avoid soy because it could cause breast cancer because it has phytoestrogens. Oh, genistein is one of those phytoestrogens. And, you know, and we know that human estrogens can actually fuel some types of breast cancer. But it turns out that plant estrogens like genistein actually is nothing like human estrogen. And so it doesn't do the same thing. And in fact, can counter its effects. And so in my book, I write about the fact that foods like soy that contain genistein can cut off the blood supply to feeding cancers. This would also apply to lymphoma. But what's really remarkable is that a study of 5,000 women who already have breast cancer showed that those women with breast cancer who ate more soy actually had almost a 30% lower risk of mortality from their disease. And if they were successfully treated, those women who ate more soy also had about a 32% decreased risk of the cancer coming back. Genistein is the reason that that occurs, and we even know the dose of the soy you need. It's about 10 grams of soy protein a day, which is about the amount of soy you would actually get, soy protein you get in about a cup of soy milk. And so this is really the kind of research I try to describe is, you know, going from the population study down to the clinical trial, down to the molecular study, down to the cellular study, so we understand as much as we possibly can.
Well, I'm glad you bring it up, and thank you for helping clear the clouds away when it comes to soy. I'm always trying to talk about it when I get the chance, because a lot of people are drumming these myths that are simply not true and not helpful. And then the next one that I thought was really fascinating was apple cider, and was it apple cider juice and apple cider vinegar? It helped lymphoma, and you only had to have it like twice a month or something like that.
So studies that actually looked at people consuming apple cider or apple juice have found that, you know, consuming the apples are apple cider. By the way, it's got to be cloudy, right? So if you look in the grocery store for apple cider, you'll see in the refrigerated fresh section, you'll see the apple cider that's cloudy. You can't see through it. if you go to the middle aisles and you look for, you know, in the where the drinks are, you'll actually see the crystal clear stuff. I mean, it's kind of yellowish, but you can see right through it. And so the thing is that the difference between the cloudy and the clear is that the clear one's been filtered, and in filtering it, they actually take away a lot of the good stuff. So apple cider has a lot of different types of bioactives that are actually found inside the apple. Chlorogenic acid, quercetin is also in apples, by the way, and it's also found in the peel. It's found in the cloudy stuff in apple juice. And so what does that do? It actually helps to boost the immune system. It's anti-androgenic. It actually can, the fiber in apples, by the way, that's found in the cloudy apple cider can also help feed the microbiome. So what I'm encouraging the readers to do is really try to take an entirely fresh look at how foods impact their body, first by thinking about their body. Like, you know, we understand how the body works, and so now let's just think about how the different foods that we might choose, which system do they activate? And that's really how I think there's a really practical way to just choose foods that activate one of the five defense systems.
Okay, let's now concentrate a little bit on my favorite subject, which is food and eating food. Mm-hmm. And the first food I want to talk about is the purple potato. I first heard about this when you were being interviewed by John Robbins at the Food Revolution Summit. And you talked about purple potatoes and stem cells. And I want to hear a little bit more about that. And I want to also ask you, is it what's true for purple potatoes true for purple sweet potatoes?
Right. So first of all, potatoes, you know, many of us grow up thinking that potatoes are just all white, right? Like mashed potatoes, the classic mashed potatoes. But in fact, potatoes are like hundreds of different colors. And in Peru, in South America, where the potatoes originally came from, or the Europeans first discovered potatoes and brought them to Europe, the purple potato was sort of like the king of potatoes. It was really the prize treasure. It was a potato that royalty ate. Fast forward to today, and we now know that that purple color is actually imbued into the potato by natural chemicals, natural dyes called anthocyanins. And those natural dyes actually have powerful effects in our body, including on our stem cells. So Professor Jairam Vannamala is actually a researcher at Penn State University, a colleague of mine. And we were discussing sort of what it is that purple potatoes could potentially do. And it turns out that purple potatoes actually can kill cancer stem cells in the research lab. Now, cancer stem cells are these little baby stem cells that give rise to more cancers, and they're the reason that cancers come back, even when you actually successfully think you've gotten rid of the cancer. You know, we all know somebody who's had cancer in the past, and they look perfectly fine, and then all of a sudden, years later, out of the blue, the cancer comes back. That's because of the cancer stem cells. Finding a way to get rid of cancer stem cells is the holy grail of cancer research. And guess what? Purple potatoes have been shown through research to kill cancer stem cells, specifically colon cancer stem cells, which is really quite remarkable. The research that's been done, by the way, looked at the raw potato, the steamed potato, the mashed potato, the potato, purple potato chip, all does the same thing, which is quite remarkable. And because it's the dye in the potato that does it, other purple potatoes, like the purple sweet potato, also have that potential to do the same thing, although they haven't been studied specifically as such. But because it's the same color, same natural chemical that's creating the coloring, it can actually do that as well.
The reason I ask is I prefer to buy organic. And when I go to Whole Foods, they have organic purple sweet potatoes, but they have conventional purple potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
So I get the purple sweet potatoes. But then I guess that other foods that contain anthocyanins like red cabbage and blueberries might also be working against those bad cancer stem cells.
Absolutely. It has not been studied yet by food, but that's in the future. You know, so what I try to do is present the science wherever it is, right? That's the amazing thing is that, you know, from this, you know, what I'm hoping is that, you know, a researcher might look at what's in the book and say, oh my gosh, that's a cool thing for us to study next. Now let's look at other foods that would have it. And that's the nature, the ripple effect of reporting science, is we get more people interested in uncovering more layers of that onion.
And me, I'm interested in eating all of those good foods that you discover.
me as well.
Now, you have a recipe called broccoli stem and oregano soup. And what I loved about it is many people just throw the broccoli stems away. And this was a great way to use the stem. I also do a lot of green juicing. So if I don't want to cook the stem, I'll juice it.
Sure.
But you mentioned that kale stems were inedible. And I just wanted to ask you about that because I juice them and I also chop them up like you do the broccoli stems. Is that okay?
Well, of course, most of the plant is actually edible, and in fact, you know, stems have an incredible amount of fiber, which is a prebiotic. So it actually feeds our gut bacteria, which then will chop them up and turn them into useful pieces that actually can lower inflammation in the body. But from a recipe perspective, you know, usually we're cooking for guests. And if you're not juicing, and not everybody is, you know, perhaps as conscientious as me or perhaps as you, you know, the stem, and depending on where you get it in the grocery store, sometimes, you know, the stem can be kind of like dried out and much harder, really hard to eat. What you do is just, like the chefs say, just you slice away these huge fronds on both sides of the stem. But absolutely, if you can actually use a stem, that's good. You know, one of the recipes that I talk about is a broccoli stem soup. And this is research that I did a few years back. I was really curious because, you know, when we're kids, we're always told that we should eat our broccoli, and it's just the treetops that we're usually served. And, in fact, if you ever go to a frozen food section and look for frozen vegetables, sometimes they're actually good because they're flash frozen, you know, not too far from the field. If you open a bag of frozen broccoli florets, as I call them, they're all perfect sized and, you know, and the small little kernels. But in fact, anybody who's been to a farmer's market knows that the treetop of the broccoli is only a small part of the broccoli. It's mostly this gigantic green stem. And that's what winds up getting chopped away or even thrown away at home. And what we did is we did some research to say, if you wanted to look at the anti-angiogenic, cancer-fighting, defense-enhancing properties of broccoli treetops, the florets, how would they compare to the stem, to the power of the stem? Do they have the same stuff or not? Well, here's what we found. We found that the broccoli floret, the treetop, is indeed quite powerful as a cancer-starving food. So that's a checkbox. Like, we always knew that broccoli tops are going to be good for you. But here's a big surprise. When we looked at broccoli stems, which no one had ever looked at before for this property, we found that the stem of the broccoli has twice the cancer-starving property as the treetop, as a floret.
Whoa, I'm excited.
Amazing, right?
That is. That's fascinating.
By the way, we also did the same experiment with, you know, we were thinking, okay, let's tear a page from our own playbook and let's take a look at other foods that you get at a farmer's market where you're throwing parts of it away. What do you think we chose? We chose carrots, right? So the orange carrot, they call it the taproot, is what we normally eat. But when you go to the farmer's market, you're getting this gigantic bushel with, you know, a little bunch of orange carrots at the one end and this monstrous green stuff on the other side. Right? So what do most people do? Like, I used to do this myself. You cut off the greens, you throw them away, and then you clean up the carrots and cook with them. Turns out that we asked, you know, what about the cancer-starving properties in the carrot? Yes, absolutely, it's there. It's incredible. It's great, healthy, good for you, just like we knew carrots would be. But then we also looked at the carrot tops, the greens. And again, they had twice the potency of the actual orange taproot. So,
wow.
Got to think about the parts that we throw away are good. By the way, I'm going to take your listeners to one more research experiment. Mushrooms, right? Let's take a look at the lowly white button mushroom, or really any mushroom. They contain this natural chemical called beta-glucan. Beta-glucan does a lot of things. It's cancer-starving, blood vessel right-sizing. It also boosts, it's known to boost your immune system. Now, it's found all over the mushroom. And what happens when you buy a mushroom, white button mushroom? We normally take it home. We kind of clean it off, get all the dirt off. And then we cut off the mushroom cap, and we start cutting and dicing in the cap, and we usually toss the stems. Most people do. Maybe you don't.
I don't.
I knew that. I knew that was going to be your answer. But it turns out that the beta-glucan, there's three times more beta-glucan in the stem as there in the cap. So next time people eat the mushrooms, eat both the caps and the stem. Think about using the parts that are thrown away. Mother Nature's very, very resourceful. There's hardly any food in which she hasn't packed some good stuff in the parts that, you know, we sometimes ignore.
Okay, so this is very exciting for me because, number one, I don't like to waste. And everything that I buy, nothing goes bad. I eat everything. And I'm always making sure things don't last too long in the freezer or the pantry. I'm always very, very mindful of all of that. So I don't like to waste. Now, that's really interesting about carrot greens. I've tried to eat carrot greens, and maybe you have a good recipe for them, because I found that they didn't taste very good.
Well, you know what? In the Mediterranean, they actually use carrot greens because, you know, many places that are not particularly wealthy or more rural areas, they really eat everything they can get. You can actually pickle carrot greens, and you can also make a pesto out of them.
Okay.
So think about, you know, using the carrot greens and, you know, blending them up and putting some olive oil, some pine nuts, some garlic. You know, you can really make that into something that can flavor, you know, some other foods that you're cooking.
Very exciting. I'm going to revisit the carrot greens. That's very exciting. And then the other thing, the broccoli stems is fascinating. And, you know, I'm glad I've been juicing them and cooking with them and saving them. And we learn all these strange things about what we shouldn't eat or what's too chewy or too seedy or too this and too that. And we need to kind of re-educate ourselves. So this is great. And then the mushrooms. There was a while a few decades ago where we thought there was nothing in a mushroom. It had no value nutritionally. And now we've learned what a powerhouse they are. And I used to like to make stuffed mushrooms, and people would say, what do you stuff them with? And I would say, I stuff them with mushrooms. I would chop up the stems and put them with garlic and put them back in the mushroom. But I didn't know. I just didn't want to waste it. But it has good stuff in it. That's fabulous. I can't wait to try carrot greens.
Yeah.
In a pesto or something.
Definitely worth thinking about. And, you know, like in the flavors, you can actually light them up with other ingredients that are in my 200-plus foods that have scientific evidence. And so what the nice thing is that you can take something you're not really sure about. So in my book, what I'm really trying to tell readers is lean into the foods that you love. Look at those 200 foods. Hardly everyone can find something they love in some category, a fruit, a vegetable, a legume. You know, I even talk about chicken thighs. There's red wine, there's beer, there's different kinds of cheeses. Every single thing that I mention has some scientific evidence. I've cited 700 references in there. But if you start with the foods that you love for health, you're already ahead of the game because, you know, unlike a lot of diets where you kind of dread figuring out what you got to cut out, in this particular case, it's following the science of what foods you can add to your diet.
Very good. And you say throughout the book that we all should be focusing on a whole food, minimally processed diet, avoiding refined foods, and eating a lot of plants, which is an ongoing theme that all of us really need to get.
Yeah. I mean, you know, look, even though it seems like it's new research and, you know, some critics even, you know, say, well, you know, maybe we don't really know enough yet. If you really take a look at the history of humanity and human beings, we've mostly eaten plants. It's been really, until we've been able to industrialize non-plants, the plants were what we actually ate. So I'm not espousing by any means a special diet. I did not write this book to create a diet, which basically implies one size fits all. Instead, what I'm basically saying is that, you know, there are patterns of eating, and there's sort of a philosophy and attitude towards food that really can allow us to love our food as we love our health, as opposed to thinking that they're somehow contradictory. If you want to be healthy, you can't love your food. If you love the food you love, you can't be healthy. Like, that's really the mantra that's out there in the public. And what I'm saying is that, look, there's a whole new way to look at it, which is, what's the evidence supporting the foods that we love? Eat those.
Now, you are one of those few doctors out there that also know your way around the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And I give you big pluses for that. because it's important not only to know about nutrition, but know that these foods are so good for our health and how to prepare them, because so many people are lost in the kitchen. So your book also includes a pretty comprehensive section of kitchen tools and things that we need to have in order to prepare our food in a delightful way.
Right. Well, you know, I think that the people who are most comfortable with food and health are the people who really enjoy eating and enjoy cooking. Because when food becomes second nature to us, as it used to be many, many, you know, years ago when life was simpler, you know, we didn't have as many distractions. I mean, think about how super high technology like mobile phones, like even a 6-year-old kid will know how to use them expertly now. Well, back in the day, you know, the things that were commonplace were food, and people understood them. And somehow we've lost touch with that. So the people that actually know the food the best or are most comfortable with are people that cook. And what I want to do is to demystify not only the science of the food, but the fact that, you know, we can handle it, we can buy it, we can store it, we can shop for it, we can, we can cut it up and cook with it and steam it, saute it, you know, roast it. So I talk about different techniques that, you know, that anybody can approach and make it as easy as possible. And I also talk about, you know, things that are in your pantry, because, you know, the pantry is our larder, okay, is, by the way, you know, the word pantry, P-A-N-T-R-Y, came from the French word pen, P-A-I-N,
pain,
which is bread,
pain,
right?
Pain.
So people du used
pain.
To store,
it's pain, pronounced du pain.
Pain. Right? So it used to be just to store bread in there, right?
Yeah.
But now we everybody clutters it up with all kinds of stuff, right? Somebody brings you something, you bring something back from a trip, just pop it in there. And so I talk in my book about cleaning out the pantry, you know, and really making sure you stock it with those elemental things, dried beans, you know, spices and herbs, olive oil, those things that are like the core things that really will make sure that whatever you reach for in your kitchen is going to be healthy.
I have one more food question. You have a list of grand slammers, and of course kale is there, but there were some other foods I was surprised to see there, like bamboo shoots. But the one that I was really surprised was eggplant. What is so spectacular about eggplant?
Well, eggplant actually contains a number of bioactives, like all of these grand slammers do. So first of all, let me just tell you what a grand slammer is. I talk about the five health defense systems, and then in the second part of my book, I talk about foods that activate each of these defense systems. And as you mentioned earlier, Karen, that some of these foods come up over and over again. And it turns out there are some foods that are just so versatile in activating our health defense systems that they activate all five health defense systems at the same time. And you know, those would be the foods that would be the most efficient to eat. So I just wanted to kind of make it simple for people. I have a whole chapter that's called Exceptional Foods. And among categories of exceptional foods, I have the Grand Slammers. And so eggplant is in there. It contains a large number of bioactives. I mean, look at the color, that beautiful purple color. Look at that sort of unusual taste that it actually has. Beautiful taste that you can roast and it softens up. Packed with natural chemicals that help our circulation, can stimulate our stem cells. Feeds our microbiome. Some of this fiber in the eggplant can feed our healthy gut bacteria, which can lower inflammation, protects our DNA, and also can help guide our immune system to be to function at a healthier level. So, like any food that I have in my book, if you slather it with unhealthy things, you know, layer it with processed food, or you know, or dunk it with saturated fats. I mean, you'll kind of defeat the purpose by adding too many bad things to the good things. But, you know, I think that, you know, generally speaking, and this is a whole other conversation you and I could have if you want to talk about food, is how do you combine the foods together for optimal health? But yeah, eggplants are great. Bamboo shoots are great. I have some other very unusual foods like squid ink, you know, the black pasta you sometimes see now. You can get almost anywhere now. That's also a grand slamming food. And then stone fruit. You know, I love stone fruits. They're a whole series of fruits that have the pit in the middle, right? So apricot, peaches, pears, you know, I mean, not the pears, but apricot, peaches, plums, all those great things that come out, nectarines in the summertime, but also mangoes, right? So mangoes are one of my favorite fruit, and it's a great source of vitamin, but has all these other bioactives that activate our all of our defense systems. And, you know, a couple of slices of a mango in the morning is like something I really love to have.
Mango is like candy.
Yeah, well, you know, and some people actually have critiqued mangoes by saying that it's got a lot of sugar in it. But I always try to tell people that food is very complicated, and if you try to just assign a good guy or a bad guy role to just one element in it, you've kind of missed the point. Although there is a lot of natural sugars in mangoes, it also contains a huge amount of vitamins and a lot of other bioactives and fiber that can actually feed your body as well. So the net-net is actually healthy.
Well, I'm sure you know this, but there's been research that shows that when we consume sugar in the form of whole fruits, the body manages it much differently than if we had refined sugars.
That's right, and added sugars as well.
And added sugars. What do you mean by added sugars?
Well, you know, one of the things that happened in the processed food world is that, you know, there's a lot of extra sugar that gets added to our food. You know, if you take
sugar in tomato sauce and everywhere.
Or sugar-sweetened beverages and those kinds of things. They're, you know, in the mass market of foods, you know, what I try to talk about in my book is really focusing on elemental ingredients, foods that are from the sea, from the land, you know, from the soil. Those are sort of, you know, pluck them up and clean them up and cook them up kind of thing. It's pretty simple, and combine them with other whole fresh foods. That's really the way that healthy eating is actually done. But, you know, somewhere along the line and during industrialization, which is, you know, very much part of our society, and it does make food readily available, lots of things get added to our foods, and some of those things are not so good for us, and that's where added sugar comes in. You know, there's a lot of extra sweeteners that our body doesn't need, and over time it makes our body handle the sugar in more and more awkward ways.
Okay, well, we're just about at the end of the program, so we've touched on a lot of things, but this book is fully loaded with so many different ideas and things that food can do for us. I'm not sure if I skipped one that you want to mention, but if there's anything you want to add in the next few minutes.
Well, you know, one of the things that I wanted to clear up is this whole idea about tomatoes. You know, some people say that tomatoes are related to nightshade, and therefore it's toxic, and there are these things called lectins that destroy your joints.
Oh, the lectin debacle.
Another urban legend that's out there.
Yes.
And, you know, this is why science is so important. Science generally tries to tell the truth. And it's very easy for people to make all kinds of claims, but really tomatoes are an amazing source of vitamins. It tastes great. And actually, their flesh and their skin contain a natural chemical called lycopene. And lycopene is a natural anti-angiogenic, cancer-starving substance that I write about in the book. And there's been some amazing research. In fact, I cite a study of 46,000 men that showed that those who ate 2 to 3 servings, these are half-cup servings, of cooked tomatoes, tomato sauce, every week had a 30% decreased risk of developing prostate cancer. Why? Because lycopene cuts off the blood supply to cancer, makes it harder for them to grow. And why cooked, not raw? Because the lycopene that comes from a tomato you would pick in a garden and eat like an apple comes in the chemical form your body really doesn't like to absorb. But if you heat that tomato, the temperature, the low simmering temperature, slowly changes the chemistry, the natural chemistry of the lycopene, into a form your body loves to absorb. And so this is where cooking, you know, the joy of cooking, making a tomato sauce, can actually make something even healthier for you. Heat doesn't always destroy the good stuff. Sometimes it brings it to life.
I'm so hungry now. A slow simmering tomato sauce, stirring with a wooden spoon.
Exactly.
Now, another thing about tomatoes, it tickled me. Tomatoes and watermelon. You mentioned that if we drank watermelon or ate watermelon or watermelon juice or tomatoes before we went out in the sun, it was protective against the harmful rays.
So, you know, it's amazing that something like watermelon or these other types of juices can actually protect us against damage. You know, early on, I talked about the fact that DNA protects us, right? So you go outside, the sun hits you, and you know, a little bit's okay, but a lot of it you know, over time, really will start to mutate and damage our DNA. And so, so actually eating some of these foods, think about some of the classical having watermelon in the summer, right? So watermelon contains lycopene. It also protects our DNA. And having it before being exposed to sun actually protects our DNA. Citrus juice can do the same thing. I cite a study that blows my mind, which is they studied a couple of young guys in their 20s, healthy people, young people, and they measured the blood to see how well their DNA would protect itself at the very beginning, and then just gave them a single glass and a half of orange juice, right? So I'm not espousing drinking a ton of orange juice, but you know, this experiment showed that you actually drink orange juice and only 20 minutes later, you could protect your DNA by 20%.
Fascinating. So fascinating. The whole book is fascinating. Dr. Lee, thank you for joining me on It's All About Food and sharing all of this great information. Eat to Beat Disease is the name of the book, The New Science of How Your Body Can Heal Itself. And we've come to the end of the program. So thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Karen. It's such a pleasure to speak with you.
Okay. Everybody, thanks for listening. This has been It's All About Food. I'm Karen Hartglass. You can find me at responsibleeatingandliving.com. Send me comments at info@realmeals.org. And have a delicious week.